LinkedIn News.
The principle of sufficiency is if you let go of trying to get more of what you don't really need, which is what we're brainwashed to want more of, it frees up all the energy tied up in that chase to turn and pay attention to what you already have. When you pay attention, when you give it your love, your intention, your attention, it expands before your very eyes. Another way of saying that is what you appreciate appreciates.
So that's Lynn Twist. I'm Leah Smart, and this is Everyday Better. Make sure you hit that follow button to get new episodes of our podcast every week. Our conversation starts in just a few moments.
The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. TIAA makes you a retirement promise, a promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
Hey everyone, from LinkedIn News, I'm Leah Smart, and this is Everyday Better, a personal development podcast where every week I sit down with some of the world's brightest minds and bravest hearts to learn how we can improve ourselves, our relationship to others, and the world around us. It's Women's History Month, so we're featuring exceptional women who are introducing new ways of thinking. This is Women Making Waves. This week, Lynn Twist and I sat down to talk about her groundbreaking book, The Soul of Money, Transforming Your Relationship with Money and Life, and her current work, including a book called Living the Committed Life, Finding Freedom and Fulfillment in a Purpose Larger than Yourself. Lynn piqued my interest with her first book. She dove into her own untangling from what she calls the toxic myths of money and the great lie of scarcity. She calls these unconscious, unexamined paradigms that keep us inextricably and often negatively tied to money in a way where it has power over us, not with us, or even us having power over it. Lynn's work took her all over the world to the richest and poorest people, even to civilizations where people don't have money or use money at all. And where she ended up was right back at home with a renewed paradigm on how she wanted her relationship with money to unfold for the rest of her life. She went on to share that with the world, to found the Soul of Money Institute and the Pachamama Alliance. And today, she and I are talking about everything she's learned, how we can rewrite our relationship with money, no matter how much or how little we feel we have, and ways that you can devote your life to something meaningful and bigger than yourself. It was an absolute honor to talk to her. Here's Lynn.
Well, I've been fortunate in my life to be in the presence of real remarkable human beings who've role modeled and taught me to have a purpose larger than my own life starring me. And it starts with Buckminster Fuller. He was a futurist and a humanist and an engineer and an architect. And he coined the phrase that a little individual can lead a life that makes a difference for all of humanity. And that to live that way, whether you believe that or not, gives you a life of true meaning and fulfillment. And that has been guiding me ever since. And also Werner Erhard, who founded EST and the Landmark work. And then I got involved in the Hunger Project because Werner Erhard and Buckminster Fuller really came together and saw we could not only address the suffering around hunger, but we could actually end world hunger. And so that bold commitment, which is larger than my own life starring me, into really living a life of service, actually. And when you make a commitment, I think, larger than your own life, that commitment comes back and shapes you into who you need to be to fulfill it. Then that commitment makes you, forges you into the person you need to be to fulfill it. And that has happened to me. And it's given me the opportunity and privilege of working with Mother Teresa, the Dalai Lama, you know, Desmond Tutu, and also some of the most resource poor people on earth in Ethiopia, Bangladesh, Guinea-Bissau, Harlem. So I've been so fortunate to live a life of commitment that has given me relationships I never could have had without that commitment, and a path that has really inspired me to be the best person I can be.
I'm inspired by it. I mean, I read your book during lockdown in 2020, Soul of Money, and it totally shifted everything I thought about money, but also about like my own commitments at the time. to what I wanted. And, you know, I love how you talk about like my life starring me, you know, like how do I get out of that? You didn't start this way, right? It's like in the beginning of the book, you talk about how you and your husband had gotten caught up in the cycle of affluence. And it meant that in some ways you weren't fully experiencing your lives in the way you really wanted to. And so you kind of had this come to Jesus moment. Can you talk about that? Because when you talk about this commitment to something larger than your own life, I think everybody would love to be in a mental and emotional state to be able to do that, because it sounds incredible. And I think it does change you. But not everyone knows how to get there. And I don't know if for you, you've seen it happen only through these moments where you have a wake-up call, or is there something else that we can do to sort of engineer our own commitment to a larger life?
You always can see things when you look retrospectively that you never saw that when they were happening. And I would say that going all the way back to the sudden death of my father of a heart attack when I was 14 was a real catalyst. And I didn't realize at the time, because it was a tragic event. He was healthy and well. Everybody was great. My family, them were happy people. And he was a musician. So we lived a very joyful, beautiful life. And we all went to bed one night, and the next morning, he didn't wake up. He was dead. He had a heart attack in the middle of the night. It was a huge shock. And he was a musician. So our life was filled with music. And when my dad died, bang, the music stopped. The music in every possible way. When you're 14 sometimes, or some young women are sort of in love with their father, it's adolescence. You know, my dad was, he hung the moon. You know, he was the bee's knees. So when he died, I thought it was my fault. It wasn't rational, but children really often think that when there's no explanation for a death. And I started really looking at who do I need to be to make up for this, the loss of my father. And I became quite religious, but I now realize that's when I developed an inner life. So I developed a dimension of myself early on, which once I met Buckminster Fuller and Werner Erhard and the Human Potential Movement was born, I realized that I was ready for that, that I was really about transforming my own consciousness and the consciousness of the human family to create a world that works for everyone with no one and nothing left out, which is a phrase from Buckminster Fuller. That phrase just swept me off my feet. And then Bucky and Werner became completely dedicated to ending world hunger, and that became my life's work for 25 years. So I lived in answer to a sort of a call. And I feel like the tragedy of my father's death jolted me at that formulative time when I was 14 to really develop more dimensions of myself, to be a deeper kind of human being that was ready for the call when it came. Everybody doesn't get the call that way, but I think if we pay attention and we're alive now, we're here for a reason. That's my belief, that we're in an epic time in history. We're in an evolutionary leap. And all of us who come into incarnation or being born during this time in history, we have a role to play. And it's not a big role or small role. It's our role, or we wouldn't be here. And one of the great missions in life is to discover what that role is and play your heart out. And that gives you a life worth living. That gives you the opportunity to make a difference with your life, which is what I think everybody longs for. And it quiets the mind and puts you on a track to live what I call a committed life. You know, there's a wonderful phrase from Michael Beckwith, pain pushes until vision pulls. I'm so grateful, really, that those events took place in a way that catapulted me into this kind of a way of seeing the world, that my life is a gift, that it's mine to give, rather than my life is something that I need to make the most of so that I'm happy. And just see what can I do with this life that's really going to matter. And in service of that, all these amazing opportunities have come my way.
I haven't heard that phrase from Michael Beckwith, though. I love him. That phrase, the pain pushes until the vision pulls. How has the vision that you've had, how does that coincide with the reason for writing The Soul of Money?
Well, Bucky Fuller had a huge impact on me. And when I first heard him speak, I had a Kundalini experience. I had a complete transformation. And I didn't follow a lot of what he was saying, but who he was, his love for the universe, his love for the intellectual integrity of life, his love for the natural world. I received like a transmission from him, I think. I don't know that he would ever acknowledge that he was transmuting anything to anybody, but I received a transmission. That's when I saw that there is enough. I am enough, we are enough, rather than living in a world of scarce resources, where we have to get as much as we can for ourselves and the people we care about, because somebody's going to be left out and you got to make sure it's not you and yours. That mindset of scarcity that we were born into, that we perpetuate with every breath, got blown by Buckminster Fuller, we called him Bucky, in this moment that I saw and heard him say, we don't live in a you or me paradigm. Either you make it at my expense or I make it at your expense, because there's not enough for both of us. We live in a you and me world where there's sufficient resources for you and I to both make it at no one's expense. It would take us 50 years to fully realize that paradigm, because all of our institutions are rooted in a mindset of scarcity. Clearly the economy, clearly education, clearly governance is rooted in a mindset of you or me. We become so dysfunctional because they're rooted in an inaccurate view of reality, and we need to recreate them from a new paradigm, a you and me paradigm, a paradigm of sufficient resources, understanding that if you make it, you don't make it at my expense, that makes it more possible for me to make it, because we're working together. Collaboration rather than competition is really what Darwin preached, not survival of fittest, survival of the collaborative. We've misunderstood so much. So that stimulated me to write the book, The Soul of Money, because I was tasked at the Hunger Project with being in charge of fundraising. And everywhere I went, whether it was in the refugee camps in Ethiopia after the famine in 1984, 1985, or being in Japan during the boom of real estate there, or being in Bangladesh after a flood, what I saw was the enoughness in people, the enoughness in the universe, that we have what we need to have a world that works for everyone.
You talk about this in the book, The Toxic Myths of Scarcity. And this was a big one for me. You said, in a world that seems to revolve around money, it is vital that we deepen our relationship with our soul and bring it to bear on our relationship to money. But when we come back to these toxic myths of scarcity, the first being there's not enough, the second being more is better, and the third being that's just the way it is and there's no way out. Can you talk about each of those and what those do to us?
Thank you so much for asking that. So the unconscious, unexamined mindset of the human family, it was here before we were born, it will be here after we die, is a climate of thinking, an unconscious, unexamined way of seeing the world. And it's a lens through which we look. It's not after observation we decide things are scarce. No, it's before thinking, before observation, we look through a lens of scarcity. That's what I'm talking about. And I know there's places and people who don't have enough to eat, don't have access to water, don't have access to food, don't have access to a job. I'm not talking about them. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about a mindset, a way of perceiving the world. And that mindset is made up of three toxic myths, and they're lies. I call it the lie of scarcity. The first is there's not enough. There's not enough time. There's not enough money. There's not enough market share. I'm not young enough. I'm not tall enough. I'm not thin enough. I don't have enough this. I don't have enough that. We don't have enough this. You don't have enough that. So we are completely seduced and obsessed with what we think we don't have enough of. And so that leads us to the second toxic myth of scarcity, which is more is better. More if anything is better. More and more and more and more and more. So we end up with a huge, huge glut. We have to have this huge storage industry for all the stuff we can't fit in our own house. We have this huge waste industry for all the stuff we end up throwing away. We're in this massive accumulation madness that even the best of us are accumulating way more than we need on a constant basis. That's the second toxic myth. You never, ever, ever, ever get to enough. Even the global billionaires that I work with, they think they've got to have another billion.
Well, do you think then that we're using things that are external to resolve internal challenges? Because you also talk about, and obviously inherent in this, is our sense of self-worth is tied to what we have. And that's also conditioned.
Yeah. The scarcity, that there's not enough myth becomes I'm not enough. We have a deferent relationship with ourselves. It becomes a pathological way of looking at life. So we fill that with that emptiness, with stuff, with money, with what we call success, what we call fame. And then we think that's just the way that it is. We think that's the path. We get confused and we lose our way and we lose connection with our soul, because our soul is nourished and is nourishing life all the time. And not only is it enough, but the soul is infinite fulfilling. It's the source of our well-being, which is the well of being. And it's the source of our wealth. The word wealth comes from well-being. And the word well-being comes from the well of being, which is infinite in you and infinite in me. So the Soul of Money book is really about tapping into the well of being, that infinite place of soul, and knowing that our relationship with money can be one that where we connect our soul with money and our money with our soul and realize we are enough, we have enough. And then money becomes a tool to express that rather than something we have to always chase. The principle of sufficiency, and that is if you let go of trying to get more of what you don't really need, which is what we're brainwashed to want more of, it frees up all the energy tied up in that chase to turn and pay attention to what you already have. When you pay attention, when you give it your love, your intention, your attention, it expands before your very eyes. Another way of saying that is what you appreciate appreciates.
In this conversation about scarcity, one of my favorite quotes is that the opposite of scarcity isn't abundance. The opposite of scarcity is enough. And the principle of sufficiency being not an amount, not I'll be happy when I finally make X amount of money because we know that that won't happen, or when I have X amount of black pants or whatever it is, but that you said it's a context, it's an experience, it's a declaration, it's a knowing that there is enough and we are enough. And so I love that you very clearly tie this myth of scarcity to this internal belief that I'm not enough, and that the way out of that isn't creating an amount that will make us feel enough, but going back to our own source of well-being and then moving from there.
That's absolutely true. Even people who are in debt can do that. People think, well, I'm in debt. I have two kids. I have three jobs. How can you possibly? I don't have time for my soul. I'm scrambling to just stay afloat. Yes, but I tell the story in the book, and if I don't, I'll tell it now. That a woman came to me who was $150,000 in credit card debt. Let's call her Susan. She had two children. She was working two jobs. She was patching together childcare. She was just a mess. And she read Soul of Money, and she said, I need your help. I can't breathe. And I said, well, would you do something that seems illogical, but in order for me to really help you, I need you to do this for the next 7 days and then come back to me next Monday. And in every interaction you have in the next 7 days, if you can commit to me now that you take a stand to verbally acknowledge and appreciate pretty much everybody that crosses your path and everything that crosses your path and really recognize how grateful you are for it, and then come back to me on Monday, and then we'll start working on your debt. And she said, well, what's that going to do for my debt? I said, just do it and you'll see. And I said, for example, you know, when you pick up something from the cleaners, whoever it is behind the counter, appreciate something about them, that they did their job well, that they were so cheerful. You love the way they did their hair. It's something to appreciate every single person. Acknowledge and celebrate as much as you can in life every single day and be grateful for it. And she promised me, and then I checked up with her like every day. And she came back on the next Monday. And what happened for her was this. There was Susan and her debt. The week before, there was Susan debt. It was all one thing. She was her debt. She was $150,000 in debt. She was a wreck. She was a mess. There wasn't anybody to work with. So when she came back, she was Susan. She was a human being and she had debt. Then we went to work. There was somebody there. And because she realized, I am Susan, I'm enough, I'm okay, I'm alive, I can go to work on this stuff now. So I'm saying that this experience of sufficiency enough is not really an amount, it's a way of being. And we all have myriads of experiences like that. When we watch the sunset, and it's a glorious, orange, beautiful sunset, or we get up for sunrise, or we see or witness a baby being born, or we see a child that puts their little hand around our finger and we feel that connection. These are moments of absolute profound sufficiency. They're all over the place. We have them every day. And if we can dwell in sufficiency, then from there, we can build a career, we can build a family, we can build what we need to do, but not from lack. When you create and get in touch with your enoughness, your sufficiency, and you express it and acknowledge it and be grateful for it and stand in the power of that, then anything's possible.
We're taking a quick break and we'll be right back with Lynn Twist. While we're away, I want you to think about which toxic myth you'd be most curious about examining.
The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. In the last 100 years, we've seen financial markets swing, new currencies come and go, decades of savings lost in days, all showing that a retirement plan without a guarantee, quite simply, isn't enough. So more than a retirement plan, TIAA makes you a retirement promise. A promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life. A promise that pays off. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
Hi, I'm Tomer Korn, LinkedIn's Chief Product Officer. On my podcast, Building One, we dive deep into what it takes to build great products. Recently, we had Zach Perret, the CEO of Plaid, and he shared about his struggles building a financial app for consumers and how he was able to turn it all around with a critical pivot. Take a listen.
I personally couldn't resonate as much with the consumer set that we were trying to reach. I just didn't have that level of empathy. When we made the shift to building a B2B product, though, I was building the product that I wanted. My co-founder and I were creating the product that we wanted ourselves, and we had so much empathy for what that product was.
Such a great insight.
You know, in that sense, we got lucky because we were creating a thing for ourselves. And then the people that we were talking to also had the same problems we did. They were fintech developers. We'd been a fintech developer. We'd been trying to build a fintech product for a year. And so we had such deep empathy. We had such a clear ability to...
If you want to hear more of Zach Perret's story and the lessons that follow, listen and subscribe to my podcast, Building One.
And we're back with Lynn Twist. I love that you shared this story of Susan, that you shared this commitment that she took on, even though it didn't seem to make any logical sense, that she went on and did this thing where she was able to appreciate. And then also that you're pointing out this experience of aliveness that we can have in just noticing life. I think so many people, if you have debt, whatever that number is, doesn't really matter. It's the idea that we combine our self-worth with whatever money we do have or whatever money we feel like we're lacking, right? So it goes both ways. And you mentioned that Mother Teresa wrote in her letter to you that there's also a vicious cycle of wealth, just like there's a vicious cycle of poverty. And the soul of money was one where I had it for a long time. And part of the reason that I didn't get to it or didn't choose it right away was I had debt. And I was combining my own worth with the debt that I had. And so on the outside, you know, it looked like I was living in New York and I lived by myself and I had this and that or whatever. And I worked for a great company. But I also had debt that I was carrying that had insidiously shifted the way that I viewed myself and what I thought I was worth. And so my job became, as I was reading your book and I was doing some other work with this, was to get myself to a place where I could find an inner sense of self-worth, even with the debt. But I realized my biggest challenge is that I had to change my relationship to myself, to my money, and to my debt at the time. I really resonate with that, and it's so freaking powerful. And so listen, I say this, and then I got to be honest, it's been a few years. It's so easy to get pulled back into these myths. It's so easy to just plug right back into society and do these things again. It's almost harder to live a life where you stay awake and aware. And I think most of us know that maybe consciously, but don't want to think about it. How do you learn this and actually internalize it and continue to live it as we're in a world that's asking us not to?
That's an excellent question. And I myself am right with you. We live in a culture that is so seductive and so manipulative and is the culture of scarcity. Obviously, it would be really great to transform that culture. And that's one of my life goals. But I don't know if it's going to happen in my lifetime. I'm just saying when Bucky said all of our institutions are going to start to fall apart and we will need to recreate them from a new paradigm, we're so off track. But I work on that every single day. Because I actually do know heart in my heart of hearts that you and I are born at a time when there's an epic transformation taking place. We are now at the beginning of the Anthropocene. I don't know if you've heard that word. The Holocene was 12,000 years. That's when life flourished on Earth, 12,000 years. The nature and the community of life was in sync. And right around 1950, 1960, 1970, what anthropologists say is the Anthropocene began, which is humans became so powerful and our technologies, our extractive industries like oil and mining became so powerful that we are now co-responsible for evolution. We will take ourselves extinct or we will survive. And it's up to us because we created the climate crisis. We created it and we can turn it around if we choose to. So we are co-evolutionaries. And if you take that seriously, which I do, it's time to take responsibility, not only for your own life, but for future generations. And if you can make the change from a you or me paradigm to a you and me paradigm in your own life now, you can be one of the people that's actually taking your rightful role in the transformation of our civilization. And you could say, well, God, that's a burden. I don't want to do that. No, it ennobles your life. And you don't need to do big stuff. It's living in a way that you realize you are the ancestors of an age to come.
You talked about using our choices to organize life and money and then kind of connecting that back to our own human values. It may sound small to people listening, like, oh, who cares if I just do that? I'm one of billions of people. What are ways we can do that today that are tied to how we use the money we have?
We think it's that I just need more money and I'll have a satisfying life. But I say if your integrity is intact, if you're earning in a way that makes you feel good, if you're spending in a way that makes you feel good, if you're investing in a way that makes you feel good, if your financial life is connected to the goodness of your soul, of being not a consumer, but a citizen, that is the source of enormous fulfillment and satisfaction. And we don't really know that. We skip right over that going for more, thinking that's the answer. It's very hard to disconnect from the more thing. It's not that more is bad, but coming from lack, more will never get you anywhere. So practices, how do we do this? Well, number one, when you wake up in the morning, be grateful for however much sleep you got rather than, I didn't get enough sleep. Just be grateful that, gosh, I got 3 or 4 hours. I'm so grateful I stopped for at least that in the sweet territory of sleep. Wake up grateful for rest. Wake up in gratitude that you woke up and then live in a relationship with celebrating life rather than scrambling to live it. Be as present as you can. You know, meditation is really a great thing. I don't do it every day. I want to, but I don't. But that's okay. Make every interaction like the one we're having a place that you bring 100% of your presence to. You know, people are on their phone. They're tending to their kids. They're making dinner. They're doing push-ups. It's manic. It's taking our joy away. Be present with each thing you do. And then everything else will wait. It'll be there when you're done with this. And then you can do the next thing. Presence is so powerful. Presence connects you with the eternal. Right now, right here, I'm looking at your beautiful face. I'm looking at someone who's receiving my message and already has my message in her heart. And I'm looking at someone who wants to make sure that people, they'll receive this in a way that'll heal some of the wounds of scarcity. And then finally, at the end of the day, don't look at all the stuff you didn't get done that's now dribbling over to the next day. Look at what you did accomplish. Look at what you do feel great about that you did. Look at what you're grateful for. Be grateful that you filled the day with so much productivity, so many relationships, so much goodness before you go to sleep. And that will change your life. And I'm not kidding. Simple gratitude, simple appreciation, simple acts of celebration. It's a calisthenic. It's like practicing your tennis serve. The more you do it, the better you get. It's the muscle of celebration and gratefulness, gratefulness.
You said it all. When I read your book, I was like, wow, people are not ready for this. You know, it's like we are ready and we're scared of it because there's so many different paradigm shifts you have to make. And I think in general, in any area, when you start to wake up, it becomes really difficult to go back to your old ways, if not impossible. I so appreciate your boldness in sharing something that is challenging people to wake up and is challenging people to change the paradigm that we're living in and to not live in the unconscious, unexamined, but to actually look again and to examine. But I can tell that there's so much more on your heart right now than just the soul of money. And so I'm curious just to know, like, what is it right now that's making you feel most alive and most passionate about what you're doing?
I just love being alive right now. You know, it's making me cry because we have such an opportunity to make a difference. And probably every generation thinks this about themselves, but I really think we have an intergenerational collaborative opportunity like no previous time in history. You know, there's 5 generations on this planet right now that can work together people who were born post 9/11, they were born into a different world than I was born into. I was born in 1945, so, you know, I'm 78 years old, but I'm still going strong. And people my age are just like living way longer. And I'm not retired. I'm refired. I'm more passionate and fired up than I've ever been in my whole life. And I'm a match for somebody who, you know, is in their 20s. They can help me with technology that I don't understand. And I can help them to balance their incredible knowledge and incredible capabilities with the wisdom of experience that they don't have yet. I mean, we can work together like never before. And the world is so challenging, and the breakdowns are everywhere. It's not just the economy. It's not just the environment. It's not just war. It's not just gender. It's not just race. It's all of it. And so it's so clearly falling apart that we have the opportunity to be in service of life itself, in sacred reciprocity with evolution, in sacred reciprocity with the earth, our mother, with plants, animals, and each other, and future generations, and all who came before. What could be more exciting than that? So that's what I'm up to. And that's what I want to invite everybody to join into.
Small stuff. I love how you end that with that's what I'm up to. Okay. I'm going to have you complete these three statements for me, Lynn. Better humans are?
Better humans are people who are living a committed life and who know that their life doesn't belong to them. It belongs to the earth and future generations.
Better work is?
Better work is work that is dedicated to leaving this life, this planet, this human civilization better than we found it.
And a better world has?
A better world has a deep and profound enzyme and design to be a world that works for everyone with no one and nothing left out.
Lynn Twist, oh my gosh, thank you so much. Thank you for being here. Thank you for the work you're doing. Thank you for inspiring all of us to look at our lives as more than just a small little blip, but to truly take or choose the power that there is, and you said ennoblement that there is, to lead a life that means change for society, whether that's at a small scale in our communities or at a much larger scale, like much of what you're doing. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Bless you. And I hope we stay connected in some way.
That was Lynn Twist, global change maker and author of two books, The Soul of Money and The Committed Life. You can find them wherever you like to buy your books. And you can find more info on the Soul of Money Institute and the Pachamama Alliance online. One big thing before we go. The idea of reconsidering your relationship with money is a huge one. Money is so ingrained in our lives that it's almost invisible. As I started examining these myths, I had a hard time really looking in the mirror. Even now, in this conversation, I had to come back to how easy it is for me to slip right back into these myths around money. And that's okay. If you are curious to stay around long enough to hear Lynn's message, then it means that you know inherently there could be a better way to think about these myths of never enough, more is better, and that that's just the way things are. So what I'll encourage you to do is keep exploring, keep sharing, and kind of like a Rubik's Cube, keep turning it over. Give yourself the time to come to your own conclusions about how you ultimately want to relate to money and what you want to share with others. So no action yet, just curiosity. If this conversation resonated with you, share it with the first person who comes to mind. You never know how it could help them out. And support other people like you in finding our show by leaving us a rating before you go. While you're at it, write a one-sentence review telling me what you love about Everyday Better. Our team loves reading your reviews, and we so appreciate them. And as always, you can get me in your inbox by signing up for our weekly self-improvement newsletter, giving you practical tips on how to level up with small steps every day. Find it at linkedin.com/everydaybetter. That's linkedin.com/everydaybetter. Everyday Better is a production of LinkedIn News. The show is produced by Alexis Ramdow. Our associate producer is Grace Rubin. Asaf Gaudron is our sound engineer. He makes sure we sound good in the studio. Joe DiGiorgi mixed our show. Enrique Montalvo is the executive producer of LinkedIn Editorial Productions. Dave Pond is head of news production. Courtney Koop is head of LinkedIn Original Audio and Video. Dan Roth is the editor-in-chief of LinkedIn. And I'm Leah Smart. Thanks for coming with me, and I'll see you next week.